Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Why is an archaeologist leading a double life as a researcher and a regenerative agriculture worker? Why do we need to go back, way back, I'm talking 12,000 years ago, to start to grasp in what kind of transformational period we live? We go from the Holocene, arguably the most stable climate ever, to the Anthropocene, and we see the first glimpses of the chaos now, and it's everything but stable. So what can we learn, looking back, on how our ancestors managed that transition, coming out of the Ice Age to the Holocene and the birth of agriculture? What does this teach us now, as we know that the way we feed ourselves and us as the super keystone species, how we manage land, will completely shift over the next decades and millennia? Does that mean to investors, to farmers, and all of us? This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the Planet Mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt slash soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today with regenerative agriculture entrepreneur, researcher, and archaeologist, Everest, I think, which is for sure a first on the podcast. I'm really looking forward to dive deep into those different worlds and how they connect and how you combine them in your professional and private life. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Yeah, really pleased to be here.
And I don't know too much about your background, and especially when or how soil came into that. I mean, as an archaeologist, of course, you're touching soil, but let's say the living side of soil, not just I want to remove this so I can have a better look at an artifact. When did the other side of soil or the different attributes of soil really came into your life? Or did you grow up on a farm? Or what is the connection to the living side of soil?
Yeah, well, the first thing I always say is I'm not a farmer, right? I don't have that honor, but I have grown up with farmers, and most of my best friends in the world are farmers. So it's a world I've been around a lot. I've worked in permaculture, and I've also worked in various other sort of regenerative agriculture capacities growing up. Oftentimes, even before regenerative agriculture was, you know, it was becoming this thing that was regenerative agriculture. It was just sort of your...
It's not been like that. It's not been around forever, regenerative agriculture. It feels like a few thousand years.
When I was
years.
Growing up, it was just my hippie grandmother. you know what I mean?
So we coined it, and now it became a thing. Yeah, no, sorry. I'm digressing. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, but, you know, sort of how did I get into this? I've been living a bit of a double life for a while.
Then maybe the other question is, how do you get into archaeology if you have been growing up on the farming side of things more?
Well, that's sort of an interesting story. So I also grew up blacksmithing. I was a blacksmith all throughout high school. I worked as a blacksmith. And I got into archaeology partly because I was interested in ancient agriculture, but also because I wanted to study ancient craftspeople. But very quickly, once I was in the archaeology, really sort of doing my undergrad, I gravitated towards... long-term ecological exploitation. I was particularly interested in ancient agriculture. And I basically made a specialization of studying basically long-term ecological exploitation patterns with a particular specialty on the Near East in the early Holocene. So I work on periods that are really quite old, about 12,000 years ago.
Which is exactly when we imagine... agriculture took hold, right? That's where we put it.
That's a very, very important thing.
Yeah. The imagined part or the 12,000 years?
The coincidence of agriculture. So Particularly, I like to study very, very early agricultural communities, this transitionary period between foraging and farming. And it's a really fantastic period. So I want to circle back to that because that's really sort of the essence of what my work is, and unpacking that similarities and analogies between that period and the period that we're going into right now, which for someone who works on both sides of this, both sides of this area of study, climate, both in the modern period and in the ancient period, it's becoming increasingly clear that there are very, very fundamental analogies and similarities between this period, 12,000 years ago, when we're making a transition between foraging and farming, and the period that we're going through right now, which is the end of the Holocene. And we're also undergoing massive transitions to our food system, in many ways some of the biggest that humans have ever made.
I don't see that as a coincidence. 12,000 years ago, basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. And just, I mean, there's so many things to unpack there. But we're gonna start, like, is it fair to say, not fair is a tricky one, but like in that period, we went from a hunter-gatherer into a more agricultural society, which took very long. I don't think it was not an overnight decision. Nobody decided. But of course, and there were, I think, many parallels. Like it took, I don't know how long to transition into that. And of course, it led to a lot of other things. I'm looking out over a massive city as I'm recording this. You might hear a bit of background noise. Sorry for that. That's one of the perks of being in a city at the moment. But are you sort of saying that we're at the end of that loop or swing, and we're swinging slightly, we could be swinging slightly back to a more foraging hunter-gatherer, or at least a different type of agriculture? Like we've done 12,000 years, not saying pretty much the same, but in many ways, just with better machinery, mm-hmm. but in the mindset of we went down one lineage or one route of the monoculture, and we don't have to go into that, but we will. And now sort of we're swinging back. It's like 12,000, did we go through the dip of 12,000 or through this journey of 12,000 years? And you're saying actually it's very similar to that, but we're sort of at the other end. When you say similar, is that what you mean? Or what do you mean by we can learn a lot from there? We can look at that 12,000 year ago period more or less.
It's very tempting when you start talking about these things to start using the word back or back to.
Yeah, I'm not saying it in a negative way, but yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, no,
you're transitioning,
I understand.
To something. I know, that's a very good point. Okay, yeah.
A lot of people, even if they don't necessarily mean it in a negative way, start throwing around words like, back to, and has this sort of
regressive quality. It always makes me allergic, but I just said it. Yeah, that's a good point. Sorry. Sorry, listeners.
So I have to give a quick history lesson here for this, I think, to make any sense.
But also a non-quick one, because I think we need to, this is something okay. to not be quick about, because it's too fundamental.
Yeah, I think it's quite important as well. I mean, if you're an investor and you want to spend your money on improving the world over decades to centuries, you really have to understand the very long-term basics of all these things. So I think you're right. It's worth a little bit more of a history lesson. Okay, let's start from the very beginning. Homo sapiens, we've been around anywhere between, maybe 250,000 to 400,000 years. And where we sort of emerge from other hominins is of course, very, very blurry. So I have to give a very large range here. In those 400,000 years, we have lived through roughly two major climate periods. One was the Pleistocene, which was the, you might know it as the Ice Age. And then the other was the Holocene. And the Holocene is this slightly, magic period of the last 12,000 years where the Earth entered really, really stable state. So if you look at a graph of this, the Pleistocene is just constantly up and down. You might have temperature fluctuations within a single region over the course of, years to decades. Whereas within the Holocene, we stay within this tiny, stable range, which is quite warm. And it's almost completely unprecedented in Earth's history.
So it's sort of the only period where our agriculture system made sense.
In a way, yeah. So this period, David Attenborough calls it the Garden of Eden. I think that's a really, really apt thing to call it. But anyway, so humans, we've been around 400,000 years. We've gone through these two major climate shifts. The vast majority of that time is during the Pleistocene, which is A, colder than the Holocene, which everyone knows. That's why we call it the Ice Age. Less well-recognized publicly is the fact that it's also much more unstable. In my view, that's the more important quality of the Pleistocene. Anyway, so we're transitioning between the Pleistocene and the Holocene, and this coincides as neatly as anything in archaeology ever does with the transition between foraging and farming. For decades, there's been this debate over whether or not people always tended towards farming but couldn't do it under the Pleistocene because it was less stable, or whether people are developing this because of the Holocene. So it's this classic argument of like nature determinism. You know what I mean? Did we do it or did nature do it to us? In reality, it's a little
grain
bit of both.
Domesticated us or the other way around. Yeah.
Exactly. It's exactly that argument. I think that's, what is that? So Michael Pollan. Yeah,
We brought it everywhere. Huge, I mean, if they, it's not even a day, but if grain domesticated us, they did a pretty good job. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they did an incredible job. Yeah. I think, you know, wheat is one of the most successful species of grass in, you know, the entirety of history. Chickens. It's incredible the amount of biomass that they have on Earth compared to other animals. Anyway, so we've got this very, very long-term scope here.
So, and here, obviously not in conditions that maybe the weed ever imagined there would be doused in chemicals, but still they love, and the same with chickens. But it's an interesting thought, like what drives this and what triggers this. Partly, is it relevant to have that thought or not? Because it happened. But of course, to figure out what happens next, that it is a relevant debate. But you said for years and decades, there has been that debate. Did it happen because of it could, or was it always bound to happen and we were just waiting for the right window of time to do it?
Yeah, it's like we have this farming instinct always, and it was just sort of stymied and then sort of allowed to flourish, or you know, is this something that we developed for a specific period? In other words, was it an adaptive behavior for this particular set of climate conditions? In my view, it was.
Meaning which adaptive behavior? Because meaning it was always in us to be farmers? Or not?
No. So I think that humans are fantastically flexible omnivores, and that we can thrive under a huge range of different
Because otherwise
conditions.
We would have survived the ice ages, basically.
Yeah. So under the ice age of the Pleistocene, we're talking incredibly stable. One of the safest things that you can do is have a very, very diverse subsistence system. So you're drawing your subsistence from a huge different range of things. Some things you may be cultivating to some degree. Not necessarily farming, but maybe you're clearing the ground and planting seeds and then coming back, you know, at the end of the season. But then you're also hunting, you're also fishing. Basically, you're exploiting every single possible opportunity that you can to get calories. So that's a pretty classic foraging technique. And it's also extremely adaptive in a situation where the climate is going to be very unstable. And adaptive in the sense that it allows you to thrive and reproduce, so on. Whereas when you get to this period that's both warmer but also incredibly stable, in a lot of ways it's more adaptive in terms of, if you want to say, you know, natural selection even, but it allows human communities to thrive. Because it's so much more stable, there's really no reason to diversify to that extent, because it's going to be less efficient than really going all in on one maximally productive strategy, which in our case ended up being cultivation. So yeah, in that way, I mean, you could think of it as a species acting to maximize its own fitness under a given climatic regime.
And that's coming to an end now, or that we noticed that. I mean, we're in recording this in spring 23, already record heats and record floods and records, everything is being broken around us. And yeah, the current agriculture system, and people in the space, and for sure in your world, or in the permaculture world, you've been in, and others have been saying this for years, this is not fit for what's coming or what's already here. And now it seems like that's even more true. Like, how many signs do we need? So what can we learn from that period? Or why do you say, is it so important to look at that, that sort of gray area between the hunter-gatherer and foraging, and more agriculture focus? And of course, we're also foraging still on the side. But why is it so important to look at that window of time around 12,000 years ago?
Well, if we keep looking at this broad view, the Holocene is ending, and we are now, for the second time in human history, entering a period of major climatic shift. And this is what we call the Anthropocene. It's not universally ratified at this point, and I think that's, you know, appropriate in some ways, because how do you decide, okay, the Earth is entering a new geological age? You know what I mean? Yeah, we're these tiny, insignificant apes, and here we are trying to like put a marker on like a shift of this magnitude. It's very, very hard to do. But there's very solid evidence that we're approaching a climatic shift that's of the same magnitude as the one that occurred between the Pleistocene and the Holocene. This is one of the major arguments against people who say, oh, we've been through climate change before and we've continued to thrive, so this one will also be fine. They're not looking at the big picture, because if you start looking at the graphs of these Greenland ice cores, which is how we track the, you know, shifting of temperatures and greenhouse gases, the projections for the next few centuries are orders of magnitude bigger than, say, you know, some of the listeners may have heard of, like the Roman Warm Period or the Medieval Ice Age. There have been small fluctuations within the Holocene that we've more or less powered through as civilizations. But those just, I mean, they pale in comparison. They are, you know, an acorn next to an oak tree compared to the scale of climate shift that we've set off. That's not necessarily a doomsday scenario, but it does mean that there's only one analog to look at in human history if we want to be able to draw something out of the past. So one of my major arguments as an archaeologist, particularly one who's doing deep history and not just the past few centuries, because a lot of archaeologists may be looking at how past societies weathered, you know, minor climate changes. The deep historical approach is valid because you can look at this one analog. And what's incredibly significant and is not a coincidence in any way, I think, is what you are getting at. And I think it's interesting you're actually already sort of preemptively getting to the point that I've been trying to make for a while,
which
for a
lot of people, just throwing up balls.
It's, it's not intuitive, but I think that when you've been in the regenerative agriculture scene for a while, it becomes more and more intuitive. But we have this scenario where we have two major climate shifts in human history. We're in the middle of one of them. In both of these periods, humans are undertaking massive changes to the way that they feed themselves, the way that they have subsistence. So essentially what my work is about is examining these two things, juxtaposing them. What's different? Just as importantly, what's the same? What can we pull out of this that's going to give us more foresight about how we make this transition? How can it give us perspective when ordinarily we're forced to make decisions about very long-term problems that greatly transcend our generation from the perspective of a single human lifespan, which is inherently flawed, basically. So in a way, it's a little bit of futurism. I hesitate to use that word, but it's something that's quite popular in food studies. You know what I mean? You know, Vaclav Smil and various groups at, you know, Cambridge, and they're doing like existential risk studies and things like that. So it's sort of tied to that. But what I'm particularly interested in is taking these perspectives, boiling them down, and presenting them to people who are really on the front lines of this regenerative agriculture transition, the investors, the decision makers, the policy makers, and to some extent, even the farmers who are really, really on the front lines. And I think that's quite a unique perspective because it's difficult to find, because of the way that institutions are set up right now, people who have the experience with both. So I've done archaeology. I've just finished my master's degree in archaeology, but I've worked on teaching agroforestry and creating agroforestry demonstration spaces in Uganda. I've worked on supply chains for major agri-food brands, helping them get certified in various regenerative organic schemes. And I work with a climate advocacy group called Zero Hour in the UK on carbon accounting. So I'm mainly a scientific advisor on the potential of nature-based solutions in the UK to meet their zero carbon targets. So I have this background, which is both on the agriculture and climate side and also the archaeology side. Difficult to find at the moment.
And then how do you talk to farmers about this? Like, let's take the more extreme one, the ones that are really on the front line in this climatic shift. How do you have a conversation like that?
It's been a process of a lot of trial and error, mostly error, I think, on my part. So I've spoken to farmers at various degrees, and obviously you can't use farmers as sort of a monolithic term because the circumstances and...
Or land stewards, people that are definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
As Abby Rose likes to say, the key decision makers of our time are on the land. If they decide to go left, I mean, you said we've set many things already in motion, but if they decide to go left, we go left. If they decide to go right, we go right. And that has to do with all our food, our water, our biodiversity, and carbon as well.
Yeah, essentially.
Essentially, yes. And so you have that conversation, or you have a conversation like that. What was one that went particularly bad? Or you say, let's say it was an error and I learned from it.
When I was in Uganda, I was also doing this research at the time, and you know, people asked me about, you know, what I was working on back in the Netherlands, and I started talking about very, very long-term climate changes, you know what I mean, 10,000 years, that sort of thing, thinking centuries in the future. And I had this sort of moment where I realized, you know, I'm talking to someone who, it's just not relevant. I mean, there's not going to be a scenario where I can offer something of direct practical value to someone who's, you know, maybe farming at like the subsistence level.
And so what was one that went well? Like, what do you, where there was a conversation that you felt, okay, this got me something and got him or her, or at least we got somewhere.
It tends to go particularly well with, I mean, this sounds bad, but farmers who don't necessarily really have a huge amount of skin in the game, which means non-commercial farmers. So I think that non-commercial farmers often have the time and the brain space to really sort of explore these things. I consider that to be sort of a failing on my part right now, because I'd like to have something.
Yeah, I remember Matt Chatfield, I put the link below, like, I'm too lazy to be farming against nature, which I still consider one of our better titles. Bit clickbait, but still true. And he just said, yeah, I just need to spend 3-4 hours a day looking at my flock. And he does a lot of other things. I mean, he said, but that's work to me as well, because I need to observe my landscape, observe my trees, observe my sheep. And most of my neighbors or most of my friends, the farming friends, think I'm very lazy, but it's not the case. So there's this interesting tension, but he's an exception, that's for sure.
Yeah, but see, that kind of thing has to come first, right? I'm in no way advocating that a farmer should spend their time thinking about the archaeology. I'd like to be able to
build a successful farming business first, of course.
Then you can get into the philosophy of it. But where I think it really does shine is the people who are in charge of legislating and investing over the long term. Because these kind of perspectives really helpful when you're developing kind of a theory of change. I think that's something I mentioned before as well. But these debates are incredibly polarizing, which I find sort of ironic, because they're essentially between people who generally agree about almost everything. But even within regenerative agriculture scene, you find incredibly polarizing debates. And that's not to mention between regenerative agriculture and people doing hydroponics, aquaponics, or mainstream you know, like agronomics, like it's done at Wageningen or Iowa University in the United States. All these people agree on, you know, sort of the fundamental problems about what we're doing, but they have very different answers to what we do about that. It's maybe you've read Charles Mann, The Wizard and the Prophet.
I've read pieces, but it wasn't, I just don't have the time to read all of that. Yeah. But of course, the eco-modernist side and it's interesting. What do you think mostly, like, within regenerative agriculture, like what is so polarizing there when you say, I mean, I can imagine, let's say, the deep regenerative agriculture practitioners, I wouldn't say versus, but let's use versus the eco-modernist, let's just, the lab grown meat and rewild the rest. This is not the normal argument, but that happens a lot, especially on Twitter, mm-hmm. LinkedIn, etc. Mm-hmm. But within Regen Ag, what do you see as big polarizing pieces?
One of the things that I often identify as a bit of a hot point is the role of animals and meat.
Yeah, the role of animals.
Yeah, I think that's meat consumption.
Yeah, meat consumption.
You know,
within meat, regenerative. I was like, okay, and grain. Like, I mean, there you have the two big. Big pieces of ag that are probably the most damaging at the moment. Yeah, the role of animals, is there a role? And then if so, do we have to eat them or not? That's, but somehow in the regen space, it seems less. It's funny because we interviewed Charles Eisenstein and he did an interesting piece on veganism and was a bit, not scared, but we were a bit like, oh, maybe we're going to get emails after this. And then we didn't get any, not that you have to write now if you wanted to write, yeah. But it's interesting how sort of accepted, at least in our little tiny, tiny, tiny bubble, the role of animals is, but in some extent also a bit too much, I think. Like, we really, like, it cannot be done without grazing. Like, it's also, there's a bit of a focus point there. And of course, it's a very hot topic. The moment you say that on stage somewhere, especially in the general, let's say, lineage of thinking about sustainable agriculture, is a lot less or even no meat. I mean, the Eat Lancet just came out. You have to increase your animal protein, otherwise you don't get your micronutrients, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. And of course, everybody, oh, finally, they figured out vegan is not the solution to everything. So there's you see how, who picks up that news and who shouts about it is saying a lot. I think that's the meat part. But apart from that, I don't think there's too much. it's much more, okay, no, I mean, trees come first or animals, or it's the grasslands we should focus on, or it's that, or there are nuances, but it seems relatively structured or relatively, but yeah, within, but it's just such a tiny bubble compared, like everything else in ag and food is very, very polarizing. Yeah, that, I agree in that.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, the sort of classic regenerative agriculture principles are much more a unified front, particularly in terms of production. But then as soon as you sort of get past the production into like how it should be organized and supply, and then also the eating, which obviously is an important part of the regenerative system, that's when people just sort of splinter off.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? And you, I would sort of say, and you started making a point before, like I think that eating piece of we have to eat, like we'll be forced to eat probably because of shifting systems to eat very differently. And maybe, I'm not saying back, but in a, maybe that's something we can learn a lot from, looking back 12,000 years ago, like what was objectively probably a much healthier diet because we ate a lot more different things. Of course, we didn't have all the medicine. I'm not saying let's go back to paleo. Let's not have that debate. But the fact,
although there are some people who say that,
there are a lot of people saying
the paleo
that.
Diet is a multi-billion-dollar industry now, which I find very interesting as an archaeologist. None of these people are archaeologists, even though they're making their money off of, you know, claiming things about archaeology.
It could be a go to archaeology school because you can become a paleo expert because you're the one that actually studied that. Like, it could be an argument to convince your parents to make sure you can do that study direction. There's no work in there. There's not a lot of work. Actually, there is. Look at the food side of things. It's not preserved, but it comes from there.
Anyway, so you know, we start talking about these like polarizations, right? In a lot of ways, there's just no way to resolve these over the short term. It's going to take several decades before we have data that we can point out concretely and say, this is what's going to be. So one thing that I'm particularly interested in is using these historical perspectives to address what the IPCC calls like soft barriers, right? And that's really what we're talking about, you know, polarization, cognitive bias. It's the stories that we tell about where we came from that end up dictating, you know, what we imagine for the future, right? Like human beings, we can only imagine several degrees of differentness from what we already know. That's just sort of a universal. I mean, it's the reason that you have trouble coming up with fantasy worlds that don't have fundamental links to the world that you already know. Which means that if we think certain things about the past and we build our imagination of the future on those, we better make sure that what we think we know about the past is in fact true.
And which has been shifting. I mean, like we discover a lot over time and that's why it's such an interesting science. But like the things we thought were true have been shifting, the things we thought, especially on that transition period, which is so interesting. Like what's the latest surprise you learned? I'm using the word recently loosely here, but about that period, the transition period between foraging and a more agricultural focused society. For instance, that we used to believe X and now saying actually it's much more on the Y side.
Yeah, so archaeologists used to really believe in this, what we call sort of a revolution. You know, they called it the Neolithic Revolution.
We discovered a plow and there was it. No, then everything
exactly,
changed.
You know, light bulb moment.
Whoa, why then?
But it's happening, you know, quite quickly, and there's a very unstable like transition phase. But basically people just power through this intermediate phase directly to farming. That's what used to be, you know, believed almost exclusively.
Which fits very nicely in like a certain storyline we've been telling ourselves for a long time.
But, and it, even though it's no longer believed by archaeologists, it's still extremely prevalent in the public imagination, which is important given the point I was just talking about how, you know, we imagine the past really dictates how we imagine the future. The public is really, you know, it's the driving force behind this transition, and where they say we're going, essentially we're going. Which means that if you have this idea about, you know, Neolithic revolution in the past, that's when you start getting very polarized and two-sided views about, you know, like what the future of food can be. Like we have to keep going towards, you know, hyper mechanization, or we have to go back this regressive thing. And that's when you start getting people talking about paleo diets and things like that. So one of the most important things I think that is coming out of the archaeology right now is that human subsistence can be so diverse, and that there's also this very, very important productive range between full-on full-time cultivation and full-on full-time foraging. This is an extremely important thing for regenerative agriculture because this is the area that leaves room for I suppose what we would call ecosystem services nowadays, but in the past was just called, you know,
nature.
It
was just called living. Yeah.
Yeah. But when you start looking into centropic systems, this middle range, which is practiced by some communities in stable arrangements over millennia, is very, very important. Like if we look at the distribution of plants in the eastern Amazon, which of course is a very, very important area for the historical development of, you know, centropic agroforestry and many of the things that are central to permaculture and regenerative agriculture now, there is a huge... there's a huge amount of disproportionate distribution between edible plants and non-edible plants there. There is so many more edible plants growing wild in that portion of the Amazon
than there are proportionally in other places. So you're saying that's been managed in a certain way by the keystone, the super keystone species or whatever the scientific term is, which is us.
Yes.
And we've altered this quote-unquote, I'm sorry, you're going to correct me for sure. A lot of, we've managed this wild, quote unquote, jungle forest biome for a long time. And by doing that, actually increase the edible side of things much more, which of course is very beneficial to us, but we cannot really call it farming in the traditional word. Like it's not a field. Like if we look at it, it's like, yeah, that's a forest. But actually it's sort of that in between, very productive with all the ecosystem services we now really like, and also very productive on the food side.
It is, in the literal sense, a food forest.
Yeah.
Right. And what's really important about these plants is that they are not domesticated.
But they're edible.
Right. Yeah. So they're cultivated. They're edible plants.
Or they're facilitated.
They're facilitated.
We created the conditions for them to sort of outcompete partly the non-edible ones, because we like the other ones more in ways we might fully understand or not fully understand, but who cares? And somehow, created this very abundant food forest. And then when people say, oh, that sounds so amazing, but of course that's Brazil, that's in the Amazon, it's in the tropics, what can we learn from there in very temperate climates where a lot of people fortunately or unfortunately live?
Well, so part of the reason we see that in the Amazon now is because so many parts of it are extant over thousands of years. So that's just sort of the nature of, you know, like in Europe, our ecosystems are very new. Their temporal depth is almost nothing because they've been exploited for centuries and millennia to such a degree. But the archaeological evidence suggests that that kind of sort of mid-range food production was common almost everywhere. And we've got really good archaeological evidence for this from the Balkans, from the Near East, from Japan, from Korea, parts of China. And again, we sort of have to go where the archaeological evidence takes us, because it's not equally preserved everywhere.
No, which is also, I think, one of the main points, but this is a sideline I read, Against the Grain, which I don't know if you recommend, but I really liked it, especially on that transition period where a lot of the archaeology and, of course, of the history we know has been written by the farming societies, because that's when we started keeping history. So it's a very colored view on that transition period, and of course all the foraging societies that decided, I mean they still decided to join agriculture or not, which of course nobody decided, but let's say didn't kept records and didn't for instance induce stone materials, etc. We just don't know, because none of that kept, like, there's a very long transition period. It's not that we started a farm and kept everybody out and then that's sort of how society started, but we know a very small part of that history very well, or quite relatively well, and a lot of other things just simply disappeared because we didn't keep records, or we destroyed the bones in many cases in many societies. Like there's a whole area which is
well, a single plow pass may very well destroy, you know, several millennia's worth of deposition. So really anywhere that's been intensively farmed, the archaeology is practically nil.
Yeah. Which makes Brazil and other places you just mentioned so interesting. But just that let's park that for another episode. But for now, what I think you make a very interesting point, like this sort of middle place between extreme, intensive, maybe focused monoculture, relatively monoculture, and quote-unquote wild is very productive, we've seen in the past. And then, of course, somebody's going to raise their hand. Yeah, but now we're going to be with 9.9 billion people. How productive is that? In the sense, like, can we feed ourselves?
Well, so there are a lot of things to unpack there. The first thing I'm going to say in complete honesty is that there's absolutely no way of saying precisely how productive these things are. I mean, the data sets that we have from the archaeology just will never permit something like that. So moving past that and everything we've said before, okay, let's say, how do we feed the world? Maybe that's a valid argument in this case. You've unpacked this in other episodes as well. One of the first things I would say is, you know, what's the world? Do you know what I mean? Like, you can say there are this many people, but the amount of people that we have on Earth is fairly arbitrary. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing...
we didn't count them all.
I'm going to dive into a little bit of philosophy here right now. There's certain schools of philosophy that argue that, you know, more people on Earth is intrinsically a good thing. I'm not necessarily of that view. I don't think that population should be controlled in any way. But basically, you know, population is constantly fluctuating. Something, if you're looking at over the very, very long term, as I do, is you get some sort of disillusioned with this idea of like a population, you know what I mean? Because it's constantly going up and down. A century or two from now, we may not have realized the population projections that are currently going. We may have gone down slightly. We may have stayed exactly the same. And if we go down, it doesn't necessarily mean that that was a traumatic process.
Or it was a good thing, like some people are hoping for now or something.
Yeah, it's not a good thing or a bad thing, whatever.
Okay. But can we feed,
how do we feed all these people?
How do we feed? But also, how do we
feed
lots
of people? Yeah.
Like, it's great in the tropics because everything grows so fast. And that's usually the argument, or the sort of first thought people have with syntropic. But you're saying we've seen that in many, many places with very different climate, very different climates at that time and now as well, which sort of suggests it worked. Otherwise, why would we do it?
It certainly works for certain populations. My qualitative judgment here, and again, it has to be qualitative, is that that's not necessarily a problem even for this many people. Because we can bring such an area of land into this kind of low-level production that I think it's not an issue in terms of producing enough calories.
But this doesn't mean level, sort of everybody taking notes, this doesn't mean low level of calories or production or nutrients, let's phrase it differently, but like different level of intervention or different level
of farming. Yes, I apologize. I qualify that statement. So it's called low-level food production within the archaeological literature. What it typically means is subsistence with very low level of like intensive interventions. That's
an interesting term. I'm just like, as in language, that's probably triggers people, which is
this
fine.
This is part of the problem though, and this is part of what I'm working for, is that you get people from very, very different disciplines like archaeology and agriculture. We don't have a shared lingo. We don't have a shared language. So in me using a term that's completely accepted in archaeology and conceptually checks out fine on the other side, I may very well be
ignored by others because they're like, oh yeah, okay.
So okay, but I ask patience both for myself and for other people you're going to encounter who are trying to make this leap. They have important things to say, but they don't speak your language yet.
But it's fascinating because it sort of suggests, and do correct me if I'm taking a leap here, but that the whole discussion on sparing, what is land sparing versus intensifying? No, I'm butchering the quote. But the eco-modernist, like we mentioned before, like the continuing on the high technology intervention, the high intervention, there's no low level, but high level, if we stay in the same term. And then hopefully, because that's the thought, of course, there to free up a lot of other land to let it rewild or actively manage rewilding, because letting rewilding, we've seen in a lot of research, is not really happening by itself, because we've destroyed it enough. In many cases, that sort of settles that in a sense that actually potentially the most effective way, productive way, the most relevant way, or the most interesting way of this transition is to much more middle ground of where we don't separate the two too much. Is that fair to say? I'm meandering into your question, but...
No, that's a perfectly valid thing to say. I think that's generally where I fall, but I see a lot of validity as well in the arguments about intensifying and leaving other areas. I do believe that if the ultimate goal of the back-to-land transition happened and all of these people then moved back to the countryside and began farming with various levels of skill as well, which is something that I think is not often addressed, it would be quite disastrous for biodiversity. There's an ideal scenario where, you know, this sort of works. I think it is possible in thermodynamic terms, you know what I mean, and people and harvesting of energy. Tricky, very tricky. So I do see a lot of validity in the other thing. This is another area I see archaeology coming in. So you have this this polarization between, you know, people who want to go back to land and people who want to concentrate humans on very small patches of land and use the rest of the land for other things. And a lot of that disagreement boils down to disagreements over the technology. You know what I mean? The technology that would be necessary to do something like that. Technology is a really interesting thing, particularly nowadays, because it's changing so quickly. We can often see things happening that we perceive as revolutionary. They're happening so quickly. You know what I mean? Genetic engineering, you know, the fact that we can now do transgenic organisms where we take a hereditary trait from one organism and essentially put it in another. I apologize if I'm misquoting here. I try not to mischaracterize, but I'm not a geneticist. That is incredibly new, right? And it is perceived and is often advertised as revolutionary, right? I mean, if we can create a revolutionary enough technology, then it's going to create a revolution in itself. One of the things I argue as an archaeologist, it's the use intent behind a technology that matters, not the technology itself. So we now have the capacity to alter species, hereditary traits. We could do that in the early Holocene. I mean, that's domestication. That is essentially the same thing. But basically, it took us a lot longer to do it in the past. So yes, the fact that we can now do it very quickly is an important step forward, and there is nothing inherently wrong with that, in my view. But the issue is that if you're going to use this technology for the same purposes that you were breeding before, it's not going to produce anything different. In other words, you need to start. Yeah, you need. It's just an exponential curve.
Which many people say is changing anything, everything constantly. But okay, so let's take one step back. Like you have to, like, what's the intent? Like another more perfect milk producing cow that stays inside and observe, like that's not even more efficient in taking, I'm generalizing here, but soy and turning it into bad quality milk.
Yeah.
Like
so, that, I mean, that's
possible.
That,
yeah. But should
that's
we?
Very possible. Let's say that we could create a cow that produces yields that are many orders of magnitude greater than a cow that we currently have today. That would be considered revolutionary by many people. Not in my view, because it's an exponential intensification of exactly the same thing. It leads you in the same direction exponentially faster. What I'm very interested in is using these long-term perspectives to identify ways to use these technologies that sort of breaks that exponential curve. So one thing that I would sort of counsel investors to be very interested in is not necessarily shying away from new technologies, which I think is common in sort of regenerative areas. It's a sort of suspicion, which is often warranted. That it's just going to create new problems and lead to the same, you know, process which we were just describing. But these technologies are also capable of sort of breaking the mold. So let's say a genetically engineered organism that is genetically engineered to have traits to fit better in an agroecological system. You know what I mean? It's designed to fit into a system that raises the tide that raises all boats. Do you know what I mean? One thing that I'm particularly interested in, and I think is genuinely revolutionary over the long term that I generally look at, is something the Land Institute's working on. Maybe you've heard of, you know, Kernza, mm-hmm. these perennial grains. I think that is something that is quite revolutionary from a long-term perspective, because it's using this incredible new technology to produce something that has a very different function from the plants and animals that we domesticated and cultivated in the past.
And just to be clear, I don't think Kernza and other, like they have like perennial rice now, I think as well, but it's been not with genetically engineering. I mean, genetic engineering over time, I don't think they've taken traits. It's taken a long time to get to anything.
I believe they're using traditional plant
breeding
methods.
Speeding up
yeah.
with all the new technology that's coming there, but I don't think they go down a GMO route, yeah. which I can't imagine from them. Shouldn't. That's another interesting question. Should they?
I don't think it necessarily means that they shouldn't or that
others
shouldn't.
I think there's new technology as well on the breeding side to really speed up traditional breeding, to know way earlier which traits are present without mixing the traits but to really speed up things that took 20 years to like a few breeding cycles, which is already a massive, but if the direction is to perennial, which you seem to suggest that that's an interesting direction, then it's potentially valid to use almost any technology.
I believe so, provided you can, to the extent possible, account for
risks.
yeah. account for the unaccountable, basically, is what I'm saying.
Which is the argument of the point where we have to take some gambles. Don't do that, because the down mainly on, I think, GMO soy, etc., the downsides are just much bigger than the potential upsides in that case. Like,
in the way that they're currently used, I agree with you completely.
If it fails,
because
it fails,
I think that the goal is wrong
across the board in our monoculture system, which would mean we have a huge problem.
But if you're engineering for diversity,
but do you have to? Like, is it? And then I'm always wondering: like, is it so much trouble and so much money? There was a fascinating article. I will link it below on rice fortification in India, when an incredible amount of money went into adding iron to rice. And somehow genetically engineer it, and was a significant sum. And then one of the main rice experts in India said, yeah, I don't really understand why they did it, because we have some natural occurring ones that have like at least 9 times as much iron in it as the finished version of what they presented now. They just never bothered to ask. Like he said, I published on this. Like, these are peer-reviewed papers. If you just searched, probably didn't want to, but they just never bothered to ask. Like, are there anything we have, like, I don't remember the quantity of rice species. Like, you cannot imagine a variety there, and there are many that have a very, of course, also a level of iron that you can actually absorb, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And he said they just wasted millions and millions and millions of dollars, and they could have come to us, and we have a few versions that we saved and preserved, and they actually have more iron than you can ever imagine, and they're also for free if you wanted that.
Yeah.
Like, and it just showed this completely different approach. I'm like, do we have to? Like, of course,
If you had just went to talk to this farmer in Punjab, he would have been like, yeah, duh.
Yeah, of course. We have them. If you load iron, we take that rice. Of course. Like, who are you? Like, what? And it just, and not even thinking there's a bad intent. Of course, people are going to go conspiracy theory left and right. But I think he said, we published on this. They just didn't bother to look.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole other thing there about accessibility of research done by institutions that aren't necessarily like in Europe or North America. My girlfriend, she works on publishing, and she studied publishing, and it's quite difficult within publishing. It's not necessarily anyone's fault, but it's just sort of the way that the market's set up right now. A lot of the time, research that's published by people in agricultural universities that can't necessarily afford, like, you know, to publish open access and things like that. It's not necessarily that people don't look for it. It's just that it's very hard to find given the way that the research institutions are set up. That's a whole other thing. But one thing I want to say with the point that you just made,
but at least we go back to that. But if you're interested in iron and rice, take a month and travel through India somebody would have pointed you to this guy for sure. Like, there's no way that all these farmers, they know where these seeds are kept, and they know who is the seed keeper. Like, there's no if you taking the time I agree, maybe Google or the online paper directories are not the best place, but there are other ways to do that.
No, you are correct, there was definitely a failure of research there.
I realized I was making another
slip up. So again, because I'm thinking over the long term, and I don't consider genetic engineering, as we typically call it, to be a particularly different technology than things that were happening in the past. I realize that oftentimes use genetic engineering sort of interchangeably in situations where other people wouldn't. Let's break this down, right? Engineering of genetics and inherited traits, right, is something that anyone can do given enough time. So there's this connotation now that genetic engineering has to be done by people in large institutions, and it has to cost, millions or billions of dollars. I don't necessarily see that to be the case. Genetic engineering, in its truest sense, is something that communities all over the world over millennia have done in their own community breeding programs. They've engineered, in the truest sense of the word, plants that exactly fit their needs in the biomes that they're living in. So what I'm particularly interested in is taking this technology of genetic engineering, and a lot of it is quite accessible. And some of it's not even technological, but maybe these more advanced natural breeding methods where you're tracking the genes but not necessarily changing the genes. These things do not have to be focused in universities. What I'm particularly
not pointing at any fingers, but like the large monoculture focused universities, because that would be a shame. We just get a better soy plant.
What if we could crowdsource this thing that we call genetic engineering? What if we could once again put in the hands of people in very regional biomes the power to engineer diversity as they see the need for it? So what I'm particularly interested in is like local community seed saving practices. I mean, this seems like very, very low hanging fruit. Doesn't sound particularly exciting. And they're often everywhere if you travel sort of through the global south. In Uganda, there was local seed saving initiatives with almost every farming cooperative. What I'm particularly interested in is what if you could give these seed saving initiatives the training and the resources to catalog what they're doing very, very precisely, to be able to see save seeds in quite, you know, sanitary and you know, advanced ways of saving seeds so that you maintain a high level of viability and things like that. And what if you could put the ability to breed over generations exactly the plants that farmers need with the farmers themselves? One thing that I'm very interested in is these modular seed banks. When I was working in Uganda, I had the pleasure of speaking with, although not working with directly, some people from an organization called Terraformation. Maybe you heard of them?
Yeah. Raised a lot of money in the US, right?
I believe so, yeah. I think they're based in Hawaii. But one of the things they're working on, this is just one of the many things, is these modular seed banks. They essentially come in a shipping container, and it's a tiny seed saving and cataloging lab, all self-contained, all in a shipping container. And I'm not sure exactly the, you know, the financial models behind this or how accessible it is at the moment, but I think this is a fantastic idea, because if you manage to drop these into an area that has a strong, you know, local pre-existing seed saving, you know, community.
Basically
initiative.
Augment their capacity by 10, 100 or whatever.
Yeah, you have essentially given these people the power to breed in, you know, relatively short periods. I mean, 1-2 decades, exactly the plants that they need for their regions.
Funny, is it relatively short, of course, the ecologist is.
Maybe
faster, people, maybe faster.
But there are going to be benefits immediately.
Immediately, of course.
You know what I mean? So that's the thing with regenerative, right? Is you see more benefits on the long term, but you start getting benefits immediately. And when you're at the subsistence level, ecological benefit almost directly translates to like monetary benefit. Do you know what I mean? If you're talking about European farmers, I know you've had in your podcast, you have to, I think it was Charles Eisenstein as well, who was saying you have to choose between ecology and money. That changes the closer down to the subsistence line you get. Because if you're eating this food, ecology equals food. Strong ecology equals strong diet. And one thing that's a huge bottleneck for, let's say, agroforestry, but also most regenerative practices in a lot of places like
seeds,
I was working.
Getting
the seeds, but particularly any for agroforestry.
Like any agroforestry farmer or anybody that wants to, that also in Europe and the US, and is getting access to good seedlings, getting access to a good tree nursery. Mainly at the end, they start doing it themselves simply because they cannot get the quality nor the quantity. And that's should be a signal, people, like set up good, like set this up and make sure it is localized, but it is scalable and it is at a speed. And because we're going to need a lot of trees, we're going to need a lot of really good genetics soon.
Yeah. Well, if you're trying to scale, you know, let's say commercial agroforestry in, let's say, East Africa, because that's where I'm most familiar. Let's say that the crowning jewel of your centropic system is going to be a very, very high value, like fruit or nut tree. Let's say it's macadamia, right? And you have a plan where you're going to scale up to the point where that's going to fruit, and you know which crops you need to plant to maintain, you know, financial viability up to the point when you finally get to like your main sort of cash crop. And you buy a variety that you're assured is going to fruit in 6 to 7 years. And either through, you know, fraud or just sort of, you know, a mistake has been made, that macadamia then doesn't fruit for 15 years. That's a big oops. That's a big, big problem for these people. And, you know, and it might only take the wrong seeds planted in 2 or 3 places within your system, if it's a really important keystone species, to basically blow up the financial viability of the entire project over the long term.
So what would be your main message then to invest? I mean, there's so many other things to unpack here, and we're going to turn this into more than one interview. But what would be your main message then to invest? Like sort of start at the beginning, start at the seeds, obviously without giving investment advice, but like focus on the beginning of any agriculture system, which means the seeds, or is that just one of the points you would like to make?
I think that's just one of the points. My main point here is avoid the polarization and the cognitive bias that comes from the arguments that happen today. I think when you really look at the long term, like we've saying with genetic engineering, you know, these very hard boundaries that we're drawing between different technologies versus use intents, I think that's really where you have to start. And in a lot of ways, that means that you have to begin learning about regenerative agriculture without necessarily diving down a lot of the rabbit holes that are very accessible when you get into any new thing. I mean, if you're learning a new subject, you always learn the most controversial stuff first, right? that's the most vocal.
That's why you're drawn to it, yeah.
Yeah. But I suppose what I'm saying, and this is very macro level advice, is just know your history, do your research over the very long term, expand your mind, not necessarily in a creative sense, but appreciate that systems thinking happens in three dimensions. Systems thinking is huge now, right? So it's this
three dimensions. Yeah. Systems thinking. Okay.
Sorry, so three or four dimensions. Basically, the element of time. I guess four dimension. Yeah, would be time.
I mean, it's the whole thinking of the seven generations forward, but potentially we also need to look at least seven plus backwards to see.
I say much further than seven generations plus background, and the archaeological record is the only way to look into that.
So like 70, or how many do we need? A 10x? What do we need? 100x?
You basically, it's not so much, you know, like we need so and so many, but you know, 12,000
years
back.
Ago, like that transition period, you say that's the only period we can compare our current time with.
What I'm saying is, in some cases, in terms of climatic shift, but what I'm saying is go find a historical analogy and crunch the numbers yourself. I suppose that's what I'm saying. I think go find an area that seems analogous to you. And don't necessarily dismiss it because it's extremely different, because a lot of the times the differences are just as important as the similarities between the period. You know what I mean? Like if you're finding similarities between two periods that are extremely different, which is something that I often see in my research, maybe those similarities shouldn't be there. Do you know what I mean? Like if you're finding this period and a period in the past, which is extremely different in every way, but maybe we're doing the same things as they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a problem.
Yeah.
So it kind of works on the flip side as well. I mean, the reason that historical arguments are often thrown out is because the period we're dealing with is so different from ones in the past. But then by the same argument, if we're doing the same things they were doing in the past under completely different, you know, climatic regime, that's a big, big problem. That's a major red flag that scenario is not going to be viable over the long term and therefore not something to invest energy or money in.
And how do you make sure you don't get sort of paralyzed by, okay, then I don't do anything because it's just too damn hard to choose. Like, where do I even start then? Like, again, where I usually, you've listened, so you know, like let's say we're in a theater and we have this conversation and it's full of financial people, and then they walk out and like, okay, now I'm inspired, interested, or we might not be completely doomed. I like this entropic thing, sounds interesting in trees, but also we have to get the genetics right. Oof. And then just we sort of get paralyzed and don't move. Like, how do we prevent that if we zoom out too much in terms of time mainly?
Yeah, so here's the bad news. There's way too much to learn for anybody to learn. I've succeeded at this because I've been a jack of all trades, but that comes with a price. It means I haven't been able to dive extremely deeply into all these things. Here's the good news. There are legions of historical researchers who are intelligent, flexible, and extremely interested in working on climate issues. Currently, institutionally, they have trouble finding the funding to get the time to work on these things. And there is no pipeline between these communities. And there's no shared language, which is something we've talked about. If I were an investor, and for whatever reason, I was taking what I was saying seriously, what I'm saying right now, which would be nice, but you know, what I would do is I would go talk to my nearest historical researcher who works on periods that are analogous to what we're working on now or works with ancient agriculture. And I would start talking to them and I would ask them what they need to start getting more involved in this sort of thing. What I envision, what I would do if I had a fund, is I would love to be able to set up this pipeline between historical researchers and policymakers and angel investors, even, you know, impact investors, even people trying to make a profit. Basically, I want to get them talking
even
to anybody who's working. No, I don't mean that in a derogatory way.
I'm
at
just
all.
Joking. But it's no, of course, if you fund research into ancient agriculture and the connections to now, etc., let's not assume you're going to make a profit out of that, except when you set up a very successful paleo company.
Yeah,
paleo, not saying those two are connected, guys. Don't get excited.
But if you're interested at all in long-term climate, the way that humans feed themselves in a changing climate regime, if you're interested in rewilding, if you're interested in introducing extinct megafauna to, you know, new areas, if you're interested in population migration, what that looks like given the way that you know, land masses are set up. Basically, if you're interested in anything to do with ecology over the long term or climate over the long term, I guarantee you there are historical researchers who can add an incredible degree of nuance to the way that you think, but also incredible narratives to the kind of story that you're trying to put out there. So I think that we can also really, really contribute to the kind of narrative building that happens around regenerative agriculture. And it's this narrative building that's really driven it from a hippie backwater thing, you know, like back to the land movement in the US, which was widely, you know, not taken seriously by the establishment, to, excuse me, and I'm leaving out indigenous traditions there, and I don't mean to be, you know, I don't mean to do that at all. But, you know, let's say in mainstream Western culture, it's essentially the narrative building around regenerative agriculture that has gotten it as far as it can. Because to date, other than anecdotally, it cannot prove what it claims in, you know, macroeconomic terms.
You're saying
Time periods are too short.
Yeah, we can look back way further and actually show a lot of things, maybe with a different term, but that shouldn't hold us back, because there is, it's not just a term somebody invented a few years ago. Of course, like these agriculture practices have been around for a long time in slightly different forms and shapes, and have actually managed landscapes for a long time. And the only way to look at that is to talk to your colleagues, basically.
Basically, peers, yeah. So I think they can help both, you know, sort of tell the story about, you know, certain initiatives. A lot of these initiatives produce amazing videos that really talk about how their projects are integrated into the local culture, into the local traditions of land stewardship, you know, maybe what this ecosystem looked like over the past few centuries. We can extend that back into the past and therefore add legitimacy to what's happening. Or, you know, if not add legitimacy, then the opposite may maybe also be true. Like, this is where you're going wrong, and maybe we can pivot. So yeah, both in sort of an advisory role, but then also in a storytelling role. I think that's something that we could be fantastically useful in, but just hasn't really taken off yet because there's no pipeline. Even though the material that we work with has often been sort of adopted by a lot of people in this sphere already. I think anyone who's read, you know, Yuval Noah Harari, Michael Pollan, David Attenborough, you know, even Johan Rockström, I think it was at the Stockholm Resilience Institute, he's giving pitches to the World Economic Forum, possibly, you know, the most important group of bankers and, you know, maybe the most cynical of these perspectives that you could possibly assemble. And he's using arguments from archaeology about this long term, about the transition between the Pleistocene, the Holocene, and the Anthropocene. This is valuable stuff. It is a commodity, and it's something that should be really capitalized on by people in the sustainable agriculture sphere. And then I'm speaking to my colleagues right now as well. You have something that's extremely valuable to the climate movement. And if you could find the time and find brokers who can help you sort of make the jump in between these two areas, you can really contribute in a very, very big way.
And that seems to be what's missing, right? There's the storytelling piece, absolutely. The sort of structured in or foundational work, like this is not something new, this is not something, because it's of course investors and people that claim to make long-term investments, which are definitely not long-term in the discussion we had today, but are look like, okay, this sounds new, but if I go and search, it's not that I have X papers on the profitability of Regen Ag, and because it's on terminology and language and storytelling and records, and you're saying, actually, there is a lot, but it might be called slightly different. We even have that already in Regen Ag. If you call it agroecology, there's a lot more in Spanish-speaking and French-speaking than Regen Ag, obviously, because it's another term. It's a broader term as well. But there's a lot there. So it's also, again, coming back to not wanting to look or not knowing where to look in the right places and asking the right questions. But it seems, I don't know, it also feels, do you feel like it seems sort of inevitable in the direction of, and that's a whole different episode we're going to make on Syntropy, but it's that direction is like looking at what you've seen in the records, in the soil, literally, on the agroecology side, does it seem inevitable, this transition we're going in, or not at all?
I think it's inevitable, but it's not inevitable that it includes humans.
Which is very interesting. Somebody else made that, I emailed you yesterday about it. Russ Conser made that exact point in an early interview we did. We just recorded a second one with him, which should be out by now. But he said, yeah, I think regeneration is inevitable. He didn't use the word syntropy, but it would be an interesting conversation. But it might not be us. It might be. We might be, I think he literally said in the second interview, we might be put out of a job if we don't like act up soon, because Earth might not have the patience with us anymore.
Yeah. Well, we could speak to the inevitability of that as well. I mean, there have been past civilizations that have struggled in exactly the same way we have in terms of like declining soil fertility. Like soil is wealth, and it always has been, is the currency of civilization, right? We started using coins in a place called Lydia in the 7th century BC. Around 3,000, 4,000, we started operating on lines of credit. But long before any of that, it was soil. That was what rule was, you know, built on.
And maybe that signature, so, I mean, we're in an audio, but you're doing the signature, which in many places means money.
Yeah, so the money
means money, yeah. But it also can feel the quality of soil.
Like yeah,
between your thumb and your pointing finger and feel and probably taste, probably that was wealth before. You tasted soil.
Yeah. Like,
okay, this is a good piece
of
land.
It was. Money is a claim on resources. It's a claim on natural resources, right? That's all it is. Everything beyond that is figurative. And soil is the fundamental natural resource, unless we're talking about you know, rare earth minerals and things like that. Soil is really the natural resource that all other natural resources come from. When I say soil is power, I mean that extremely literally. And I think that that's something that's increasingly appreciated by investors as well. Do you know what I mean? Like if you invest in soil, you are investing in the only thing that's going to give you a return when the figurative construct that is the world economy once again realizes that it is literally tied to natural resources.
and it seems like we're starting to realize that. And it's interesting then, it's sort of even the most cynical one, going back to the World Economic Forum, and if you realize soil is power, then, or could mean return, whatever return, or how do we calculate a return is a second. But it means that healthy soils, like, means better return or more return, or and thus even the most cynical investor would be interested in soil health, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Like seems
it raises everything else. You know what I mean? It's the rising tide that raises all boats. That's soil health. And what I find very interesting is that there's sort of this view that we can kind of opt out of natural resources, like we can blast off to Mars, right? A space program is the very top of a very tall house of cards, and the base of that house of cards is food, right? Space programs don't exist when your bases aren't covered. And that's something you can see very clearly in other civilizations. A lot of the civilizations that we absolutely idealize and, you know, vaunt for the incredible art and monuments that they created, that was the tiny pyramid, the top of the pyramid that was based on productive agriculture.
Tiny period and pyramid. Yeah, both of words were actually correct.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and in terms of the inevitability of regeneration, let's look at past analogs. Many, I would even hazard to say, most of the famous civilizations of the Fertile Crescent foundered on agricultural issues. The ancient Assyrians were the first to create really, really large irrigation systems. And within about a century, they started having big issues with salinization, right? And their agriculture started to collapse. You can see clearly in the archaeological record, as farmers switch from the crops that they prefer and are most like culturally and economically valuable towards lower value crops that can tolerate the salt. And you can see this playing out within, you know, the archaeological sediment. And then at some point, it just becomes too salty and your economy becomes very unstable. And then that's usually when an invasion happens or a war sweeps through or civil, you know, unrest, something like that. A lot of these things are precipitated by agriculture and partly by climate problems, but also just partly because agriculture, when it's done wrong, comes back to bite you within several centuries. And that's just sort of the way it happens with all these
maybe some of these climate problems actually came because of the agriculture practices.
Yeah, like again, it's sort of like a chicken or the egg thing. Yeah. And it's not a coincidence that a lot of the regions that we now, you know as like the archaeological sites of the Fertile Crescent, are blasted desert. Do you know what I mean? Like, you go look at the pyramids, it's just desert in every direction. But that area was once one of the richest agricultural areas in the entire world. That was during the Holocene, which means that Earth's climate has not changed hardly at all since that period. What has changed? The fact that we strip mined those soils in order to create those monuments in the same way that we're strip mining Earth's soils now to create the top of our pyramid, which is iPhones and spacecraft and, you know, that sort of thing.
Which is a perfect one to end this conversation, actually. But I wanted to ask one more question. I always regret mm-hmm. when I do it, but I'm still going to do it. If you could change one thing overnight, what would that be?
That's a tricky question, because that's the kind of question you ask a tech wizard person. You know what I mean? So this is like if you pull a thread in the sweater, you soon realize the entire sweater just falls apart. Everything's connected, so it's an impossible question. But I'll give it a try.
And that's exactly why I ask it. Yeah.
If I could change one thing, I want numbers. I want figures. I want statistics for a lot of these agroecology principles.
What kind of numbers?
I want ways to convert between units of different types of emissions. So one of the major challenges I have right now in this sort of advisory role on carbon
accounting is that... You're going to say emission equivalent, CO2 equivalent, I'm going to laugh.
Yeah, so that's one of them. But then there are other things like certain agroecology practices, you might have trade-offs between soil and emissions. You might have more productivity and more healthy soil, but you might also be creating more emissions of a certain type. So basically you have this giant branching decision tree, and it's very, very difficult to navigate through that tree unless you have hard statistics on each one of those stages. And until you have statistics, as nice as the stories you can tell are, it's very difficult to go to politicians and say that you're going to get this much bang for your buck if you invested in this versus, say, direct carbon capture and building gullies and, you know, basically addressing all these ecosystem services separately through engineered solutions. It's nigh on impossible right now to make the kind of arguments that need to be made at the highest levels without these statistics. And I think that part of the issue is that we've come to the conclusion that we can't measure everything. And that's fair. That's valid. That's part of the reason we've gotten so many troubles. But then the fallacy that comes with that is, well, we just shouldn't try. Because we can definitely measure as much as we can and have it come along with this caveat that we haven't measured everything that's important. But yeah, I think if I could change one thing, going all in on scientific research on agroecology and putting quantitative figures to a lot of these decisions would be a huge step in the right direction. One of the most far-reaching single interventions that could be made.
Where would you start? Like, what would be, like, which region, what's the most underserved one? Or what part of agriculture or agroecology is the most underserved, you feel? I mean, maybe all, but...
Yeah. So region is interesting because, ironically, a lot of the figures that you can find are actually from the global south and the tropics, which is usually a data gap for most other things. But because we're so focused on, like, you know, protecting the Amazon and things like that and regrowing tropical forests, that's where we have a lot of the data that I'm talking about. Whereas in the UK, which is where I'm trying to produce this data for, we have almost nothing. So regionally, it's very important to go by region. I would like to have numbers for almost every major biome, or at least very close proxies. So one of the major issues in the UK, right, is that I need to find numbers for peat, you know, and agroecology based around peat. But most of the peat science that is done right now is done based around mangroves in the tropics, particularly Indonesia. And a lot of the time, if you trace the sources back far enough in these studies, you realize that they've been forced to use that as a proxy data. And it's sort of compounded until you're talking about UK figures that have gone through several layers of calculations, originally having come from Indonesian mangroves.
Which I imagine
that's not so helpful. Yeah, and there a lot of these are valid proxies.
But still, you know
what I mean? I mean, this is not bad science in any way, but it's a major, major hindrance. So I would like, in many ways, to be able to quantify the ecosystem services that are provided by a lot of these agroecology things. I know that's very controversial. I know that the Millennium Ecosystem Report was very controversial because how do you value, say, a river? You can't value intrinsic value of a river. You can't do that. But you know what you can value is you can value avoided costs of, say, natural flood management. You know what I mean? You can evaluate how much you saved in a single rain event based on a nature-based solution that prevents flooding.
Beavers,
you can do the same thing with a lot of agroecology. Yeah. When we can start getting numbers to those kind of things is when we start winning huge battles on legislation, because politicians have to follow the numbers. And in many ways, these issues are so complex that just to do their jobs properly, I mean, it's not ignorance, but they're so complex, there is no way that these individuals can wrap their heads around all of this. They need numbers, and they're going to go wherever the numbers are, because that's giving them the clearest picture. At the moment, the clearest numbers are in engineered solutions.
Concrete.
Yeah. That's a major hindrance.
But then you get into, and I knew this was going to happen, not the last question. Then you get into the whole argument we had with Satish Kumar and Charles Eisenstein as well. Okay, you put a value, you put a value or number on nature. And is that, first of all, even possible? A second, but that's let's say it is. And then you reduce it to a monetary amount. Like, okay, the river is worth that. Which also opens you to the argument of, okay, if I put the 10 billion it's worth or whatever the number is, I'm okay to dam it, because as long as I compensate somewhere else. So how do you reconcile with the putting value on nature on something that is might trigger us into doing a lot of things we probably don't want to?
That's a risk. But basically what I'm not trying to reduce it to a number. I'm trying to quantify a small part of it. Because you can't evaluate these things unless you have a couple stable anchor points. So I think in any given agroecological intervention, there are going to be a couple points that are fairly uncontroversial to quantify. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say soil carbon. You know what I mean? You're not reducing agroecology or agroforestry to just soil carbon, although
maybe a few people would go like that. Oh, it's so difficult to measure that,
it's very, very difficult.
But we can get there. Prevention of floods is a good thing. We put a value. I mean, I have to still read the book, but the value of a whale, I think, argues quite strongly against that. But the value of a beaver is also interesting.
The value of a beaver is going to be much easier to quantify than the value of a whale.
But the value of a whale, funnily enough, is not so difficult, I think, on the carbon side of things, because they absorb a lot of carbon. They are mostly carbon, like, in a way. And then when they die, it's a very weird argument, but then they die, it gets absorbed by the deep sea. So it's sort of a carbon sink. Quote unquote,
interesting.
Literally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because it just falls to the seabed and then it's anaerobic and it stays there.
Which is true, probably, but it's also, it gives me a weird feeling. But anyway, sorry.
As long as these numbers always come with the argument that this is only the tip of the iceberg, I think they're okay.
It sort of argues for like getting way more whales and then killing them and letting them sink. Like, that's not a good, like, it's like, because probably during their life they also emit methane or something. And so we're like, okay, let's let them grow very fast. And then, like, it leads to weird thoughts, at least. We're not there, of course. I mean, that's not to imagine we're there, but it does, one could see it leads to weird directions.
Well, yeah, you could definitely see. I suspect that on the whole, it would lead to positive things. And for every person you make the argument about having more whales means reduced emissions, for every 100 people you make that argument to, maybe there's one who's like, I'm going to farm whales and then I'm going to kill them and sink them. And the other 99 would be like, wow, we should really invest in whale conservation.
Or do the seaweed because it's better and fast. Okay, let's do that too. And get more beavers, but not get more concrete dams.
I think
beavers are just much better.
As long as the numbers argument doesn't become this or that, it becomes this and that, then it's fine. Then you're good to go. But yeah, these arguments, they become so subjective when you're dealing with agroecology. And when you're dealing with people whose decision it is to make numbers, sorry, to make decisions and then justify those decisions to other people, you got to have some numbers.
And the problem is now the only one that have numbers are the very engineered, very mostly not nature-based solutions, let's say.
Yeah.
They have good
numbers. Direct carbon capture, in most cases, is going to be an industrial process where I can draw a neat flowchart and I can tell you all the inputs and all of the outputs, and I can estimate reasonably accurately all the prices. Yeah.
And that's why it raises billions of dollars. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And I totally understand that. You know what I mean?
We need a flowchart.
Comparatively safe investment if you're someone who doesn't know all the rest of the iceberg that's under the water of agroecology.
That's
which,
a good
again,
place.
I think is most people.
Yeah. And that, again, is a good place to end. I want to thank you so much, Everest, for your time. We literally, I'm saying this often, it's a pun intended, we scratched the surface. But I think already captured a lot of interesting insights and thoughts, and hopefully had people think more and reach out to you and or your colleagues and your peers, because there's a lot we need to learn from the past, looking forward, not going back. We're not going back anywhere, but definitely looking forward. So thank you so much for your time here, and hopefully this is not the last one.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.